93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steve and Hayden.
I was feeling it, like, instantly. And I think that had a lot to do with Burn the Witch, which was just, like, a stunning song. You know, like, just, it just sort of struck me dead, honestly.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast, presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Before we get started, I want to tell you about something that I'm really excited about. It's the release of my first book. It's happening this week. It's called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me, and it's a book about music rivalries. So I'm talking about Nirvana versus Pearl Jam, or Oasis versus Blur, Beatles versus Stones, and there's like 16 or 17 more after that. I'm really proud of the book, and I think you guys will enjoy it. If you like the podcast, the book is like the podcast, except instead of listening to me talk, you're going to be reading me. So if you like the podcast, I would love it if you checked out the book. Again, it's called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. By the time you hear this, it should be available at your neighborhood bookstore, or you can always order it from Amazon or any of the online booksellers. If you read it, let me know what you think, especially if you like it. If you don't like it, you can probably just keep your feelings to yourself. So, again, the name of the book is Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. It's out this week, and that is the end of my plug. Here's the show. So, on Mother's Day, Radiohead released its 9th record. It's called A Moon-Shaped Pool, and if you're like me, this was a big deal in your world, because Radiohead is one of those bands that has arguably been the best band in rock over the past 25 years. And not only are they a great band, but it seems like they're one of the few bands still left who can turn an album release into a genuine event. And that certainly was the case with The Moon-Shaped Pool, because even though it was Mother's Day, a lot of us had to tell our wives and our mothers that we had to leave them and go sit at our computer so we could listen to this record. And thankfully, we were rewarded with one of the best, probably the best Radiohead record in at least 10 years. It's this beautiful orchestral record. Really great songs on there. There's songs on there that, of course, Radiohead fans love. And, you know, I'm talking, of course, about the last song, True Love Waits. And, you know, people have been speculating about why this song, which has been around for 20 years, why it finally ended up on a Radiohead record. These were all things that I wanted to talk about with someone. So I invited my friend, Jillian Mapes, who's a senior editor at Pitchfork, to come on the podcast so we could talk this out. She's also a huge Radiohead fan. We just had a lot of fun sort of geeking out about the band and talking about, like, why this band means so much to us. You know, I'm sure there are people listening to this who are sort of scratching their heads and wondering, like, why do people care so much about Radiohead? What is the big deal about this band? And if you are one of those people, hopefully this podcast, this episode will help explain it to you. So I'm excited to present that interview. But before we get to the interview, I'm also thrilled to announce that Celebration Rock has its first sponsor. And I just want to reiterate that that having a sponsor is so vital for a podcast, because these are the companies that make podcasts possible. Like, if we didn't have a sponsor, we wouldn't be able to continue to present this show. So I want to extend a warm Celebration Rock welcome to Mack Weldon. They are the brilliant makers of very comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants. They are the most comfortable clothes that you'll ever wear. And, you know, I'm not just saying this because they're our sponsor. I'm saying this because I have worn the clothes myself. And I don't want to get too graphic here, because we're talking about underwear. But let's just say that they're supporting more than this show, okay? Yes, we'll leave it at that. You know, this is a company, they believe in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. It's very easy to buy this stuff. All you have to do is go online. Just remember to go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off by using the promo code ROCK. That will let them know that you are a listener of this show and that I told you about how their underwear makes my midsection feel. Yes, because everyone wants to know that, especially Mack Weldon. So, again, thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring this show. And here's my talk with Jillian Mapes about Radiohead. Thanks for coming on the podcast and to talk some Radiohead. I know that we're both big fans, and of course, A Moon-Shaped Pool came out a couple of days ago when we're recording this. It'll be a little over a week when this podcast posts. And we haven't actually met in person, but I do remember seeing you at one point, and I think I told you about this. It was like 3 or 4 years ago, and we were both at the Beacon Theater for a national show, and I think the War on Drugs were opening at that show, and you were standing next to me, and I remember being very impressed because I knew that you were a music critic because you were taking notes in a notepad, but then occasionally you would stop taking notes and you would like pump your fist very rigorously with your pen hand, and then you'd go back to taking notes, and I thought, this person has it going on because she's a critic, but she's also a fan. This is a person after my own heart, so... It's good to be talking.
Wow, I didn't even remember that, but I'm glad that made an impression.
No, it's like I'm 99% sure that was you. So I'm glad to finally have you on the podcast because I'm a fist pumper too. So
yeah,
it's good to have other fist pumping people in your life.
Yeah.
So A Moon-Shaped Pool comes out on Mother's Day. There's a little bit of a lead up to it. You know, the Burn the Witch comes out as a single. Daydreaming comes out as a single. And I don't know about you, but for me, I was definitely going through a period of not feeling a whole lot of interest in Radiohead before this record came out. I wasn't a huge fan of The King of Limbs. I didn't really like the Atoms for Peace record that Tom York did, or his second solo record, and I can't even remember the name of it. I know that he released it on a BitTorrent site or something. What was that called?
Tomorrow's Modern Boxes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't feeling a whole lot of excitement. And then those two songs came out, and I liked them quite a bit. And then the album came out, and I really, really enjoyed it. And not only did I like the record, I liked the experience of caring about a Radiohead record again. Because this has been a band in my life that... They're the rare rock band that can still make an album release feel like an event. Like, there's not many bands like that anymore. I'm wondering, like, did you have a similar thing? I mean, like, what was your kind of feeling going into this record, your feelings about Radiohead, and did this record change them at all?
I definitely felt similarly in the sense that I kind of couldn't care less about Atoms for Peace, and I liked The Eraser, but that feels like such a long time ago at this point.
Yeah, was it like 2007 or something? Eight?
I think 2006. Yeah, okay. I mean, you were talking about a decade ago, which seems crazy. But then you think like, well, you know, there's only been up until Sunday, there were only two Radiohead records in that time. And I mean, In Rainbows is fantastic. But King of Limbs, yeah, it just didn't really do anything for me. I honestly thought the best song they made in that era, they didn't even put on the record. Like, Daily Mail, which they played in all those, like, basement shows they did, like, the live recordings, like, Live from the Basement, was such a phenomenal song, but I couldn't even find anything that compelling on the rest of the album, to be honest. And so I was kind of, yeah, I mean, I definitely was going into it sort of like, you know, bands like Radiohead, who have been really consistent and, like you were saying, like have a certain excitement around them because of how interesting the rollouts can be and just the bigness, you know what I mean? Getting swept up into it, like you want to feel something, you want to like feel a part of it if you do have any sort of history as a fan. And I was, yeah, I was kind of similarly to you, like, I was surprised at how much I was feeling it, like, instantly. And I think that had a lot to do with Burn the Witch, which was just, like, a stunning song, you know? Like, just, it just sort of struck me dead, honestly. Like, wow, that song.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, that was an older song, you know, that dates back to, like, Kid A era. And that's the first song on the record, and then, of course, the last song on the record is True Love Waits, which it appeared on the live record, the I Might Be Wrong live record, but it, you know, hasn't been properly recorded until now. But it was definitely a song that, like, if you are a Radiohead fan, you're familiar with the song, and a lot of people count that among their favorite Radiohead songs. I mean, did you write that that's your favorite Radiohead song?
That's my favorite Radiohead song, and that has been my favorite Radiohead song for, like, probably 13 years. Like, it just, I love that song, and I never thought that song would ever come out because it just seemed so removed from that era of Radiohead at this point. You know, I just kind of thought, like, is this band going to just keep sliding into making sort of like these electronic records that are harder to connect with? And then they did something that is so like human with a Moon-Shaped Pool, and you could just really feel Thom Yorke as a human again. And wow, yeah.
I mean, was there any part of you though, like maybe the music critic part in you, that thought that they were cheating in a way by putting that song on this record, because it's such a great song and it's a, you know, it's a familiar song that, you know, people were going to be excited about having it on, but it's not a new song necessarily.
That's an interesting idea. And I mean, you sort of were talking about, like, in the intro when we were talking about, like, you're a critic, but, like, you can kind of be a fan too. I think I let my fan side take over a little bit on my excitement around that song coming out. But I totally see your point. It's a little like cheating, because they know that it's a home run. They know that the fans are going to like it. But it's also like, it is their song. And from what I've read of, especially like Nigel Godrich in interviews talking about, like, oh, we tried to get this song right for a long time and it never really worked. Like, it seems like they were working at it and they finally kind of cracked it. And so I don't have so much of a problem with it. I don't know. Did you feel like it was cheating a little bit?
I don't think so. I mean, it's interesting. I've been thinking about this idea for a while about, you know, when a band that's been around for a long time that maybe you've lost interest in, and then they come out with a record that seems to consciously recall their glory years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is that a recognition that the band is recognizing, like, well, this is what we do well, and so we're just going to do what we do well as we can? Or is it, in a way, cheating, pandering? You know, is it a regression? You know, because the thing with this record, and I really like this record a lot.
Yeah.
I've really been enjoying it. But, you know, it's the first Radiohead record that I can remember that I liked on the first listen. You know, like I remember hearing, like, OK Computer for the first time and not really understanding it, or Kid A, or Amnesiac. You know, I feel like there's always this thing with Radiohead records where I have to train myself to like it. And then once it sinks in after like the sixth or seventh listen, then it really kind of takes over my life and I really love it. Mm-hmm. Whereas with this record, I felt like they're kind of doing exactly what I would have wanted them to do on this record. You know, like you said before, like, I've been so conditioned to expect these sort of claustrophobic electronic records from either Radiohead or Thom Yorke. I mean, I kind of roll Thom Yorke's solo work into Radiohead in my mind a little bit, even though it's not totally fair. But, you know, to hear this record and to hear how open it was and how warm, and, you know, the strings, and, you know, because, I mean, the primary sounds in this record are like strings, acoustic guitar, and piano. And it's this beautiful, expansive, very warm-sounding record. And I love it. But again, there was like the little skeptic in me, like the little skeptic's voice that was wondering, well, isn't it weird that Radiohead is satisfying me like right away? Like, is there something
like
wrong with
this? Like, they're not difficult enough? Like, this
Is
a famously difficult band, and I'm just kind of can come to this like quickly?
Yeah, like, is there something to that or not? I mean, did you feel that? I mean, it sounds like it was pretty instant for you too when you heard it.
I mean, it was. And that's an interesting idea, the idea of like, if a band loses something by not being more challenging at times when they've been challenging in the past. I would argue and say that I don't think In Rainbows was like sort of like miles more difficult than, or less difficult. I don't think In Rainbows was like all that less, I don't want to use the word human, but I think it's almost at a similar level of accessibility as this record. Like, maybe it's a little more challenging, and there's a little bit more, you know, there's more experimentation and there's more of the electronic element that kind of makes it more intricate sounding. Yes, you're sort of like, oh, wow, I get this instantly. I understand what's going on. But I almost think that's the most interesting thing when you're just you know, outside of Radiohead, bigger than Radiohead, the idea of artists and how they evolve over time and how they change and how, as fans and as critics, we have to, like, let them do that and we have to follow them and trust them. You know, we don't have to like it. We don't have to say it's great, but we have to at least give them the ability to do it. And to me, like, yeah, this is a moon-shaped pool is less difficult, you could say, but I followed them down that rabbit hole and I didn't feel like they were making, they didn't make a dumb album, you know what I mean? It's still very smart and sharp and well done that I'm totally okay with it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I do think it's interesting with this record that it actually sounds stranger to me the more I listen to it. Like, the first time I heard it seemed kind of straightforward, and now upon subsequent listens, like, there's things that kind of come out of the mix where I'm like, oh, I didn't really notice that. That's kind of interesting with how they sort of change sounds and warp sounds. Like, it's, in a way, it does seem like a mature record where they're, you know, like, if you want to compare it to Kid A, for instance, Kid A seemed like a very sort of upfront, like, hey, we're making a different sounding record. We're making, like, an overtly challenging record. Like, they're...
Yeah.
You know, in a way, there's a self-consciousness to that record that this one doesn't have. This one seems like it was made by people who are 16 years older and, like, have the confidence to sort of lay back and let the songs sort of reveal themselves over time without, again, making these sort of overt, difficult sounds. Like, you know, like putting, like Kid A, I think that's the second track on Kid A, or even putting Everything in Its Right Place as, like, the first song. Kind of lays down the gauntlet after OK Computer, saying, like, oh, nope, this is our electronic record. You're not going to miss it. You know, and, you know, but on this one, it does seem like that sort, like, the sort of weirdness in the music. It's not as overt. It kind of comes out gradually as you listen to it, maybe.
Yeah, I'm still finding things that I'm, like, individual parts and things that I'm like, oh, man, that's a lot more interesting than I had even picked up initially. Like, I was listening this morning to Tinker Tailor, Soldier, Sailor, the title goes on.
right.
I was just thinking, man, the percussion on this is just very intricate, you know what I mean? Like, it's really special and, you know, it's not difficult, but it's just very well done, you know? It's nuanced and... it's funny to think about this record in comparison to Kid A, because Kid A is, like, to me, like, you know, OK Computer was, like, so many people came to the party, and Kid A was a little bit like, okay, we want some of these people to leave the party.
Right.
And I think, I don't want to say that King of Limbs had some people going for the door, but it definitely had the excitement levels down, and I do think if they had made another record that was on that vibe... You know, people love Radiohead regardless, and I think Radiohead fandom is one of those things that's sort of lifelong for people who really, like, love them, you know? So I don't think they would have lost the diehards by any means, but a little bit, like, I think they needed to, like, make a record that people would kind of connect with, you know? Like, I think it was kind of that time for them.
Yeah, I think I disagree with you, because speaking for myself anyway... If they had made another record like King of Limbs, I would have checked out, I think. I mean, I was already feeling like I was checking out anyway, just not only because of King of Limbs, but also because of the Thom Yorke solo stuff, which was not really doing much for me. And also the fact, too, that, and you alluded to this before, but, you know, In Rainbows comes out in 2007, King of Limbs is 2011. You know, there's a 4-year gap between those two records, and then there's a 5-year gap now between King of Limbs and A Moon-Shaped Pool. It just seemed like maybe Radiohead was winding down a little bit. Didn't seem like they were terribly maybe engaged, you know, with still being a band, you know, and that's a hard thing to do. You know, lots of bands deal with that at this point, like, in their careers. I mean, you know, there's nothing that Radiohead is going to do probably at this point that's going to top the Bends, OK Computer, and Kid A as far as just being, like, hugely kind of important records. I mean, I think they've made great records after that, but, you know, they've kind of done it already, I think, in a lot of respects. So it would be easy, I think, for them to sort of stop caring and either sort of fade away gradually or maybe just do an occasional tour or something. I mean, it certainly seemed like Thom Yorke was doing his solo records, and Johnny Greenwood, of course, has been doing stuff. Even Phil Selway, I think, has put out 2 solo records since King of Limbs. So I guess in that respect, I was also surprised by this record because... again, it just seemed to me that maybe they were on the downswing a little bit as far as like the members really sort of being invested in this band.
Yeah. No, I see that too. And it's funny, after this record came out, listening to it, there is a thought that I had that I don't, it just kind of popped into my head where I thought, like, what if this is the last Radiohead record?
Right.
Like, it would be kind of a beautiful way to go out, this record that feels much more, like, emotionally accessible, you know. It would be, I don't want Radiohead to end. I like this band a lot, but I was like, it would kind of be beautiful, and it would kind of make sense, not to start rumors. I'm not trying to start rumors. I know nothing. I'm not saying Radiohead is done, but they felt there was a feeling of winding down a little bit, and it's nice to see them, like, you know, coming back around and feeling like a core kind of group again, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when the track list for the album came out and I saw True Love Waits was the last song, I tweeted this thing that it was sort of a joke, but also maybe not totally a joke, where I said, maybe this is the last Radiohead record just because of the symmetry of putting True Love Waits at the end of the record. It seemed kind of perfect. It kind of reminded me of like the end of Abbey Road when the Beatles record a song called The End. It's like, well, maybe this is their version of The End. This is pure conjecture.
Oh, yeah.
Our part. And, you know, I also think that nowadays, you know, unless it's like a Sonic Youth situation, like where band members are married and then there's like infidelity and they break up and then the band breaks up, I really don't think bands will ever break up again because the financial imperative to stay together is too strong. I mean, it's not like you can just, even a band like Radiohead, they can't necessarily just sit back and live off of royalties, you know, from their recorded albums anymore. You know, it seems like bands have to tour in order to make money. So I would expect, I'd be surprised if Radiohead ever said necessarily like, oh, we're breaking up. I would expect them to maybe just stop making albums, but then always leave the door open that they could, you know, headline Lollapalooza again or something.
Yeah, I mean, they're a little bit more, to me, like, morally conscious in how they, like, do their business. So
right.
I think some bands would be like, I mean, not to, like, subtweet LCD here, but it's like some bands would be like, if they knew that they didn't want to put out records anymore, they would be like, this is over, we're done, because they can open the door and make more money when they, like, you know, quote unquote, come back. But I think you're right about like Radiohead being a band that would just kind of like be kind of quieter about it, you know, like leave the door ajar to do stuff, because you also get the sense that they actually still, you know, like each other and want to collaborate, and they obviously have individual ideas, you know, as you were talking about, and they all are sort of involved in these various projects. But watching like various like live footage sessions that they've done, and obviously just seeing them live, like there's a feeling that they like working together.
Right. Well, and they've known each other since they were teenagers, right? I mean, so it's like 30 years, you know, a 30-year relationship, you know, even going, you know, pre-Radiohead.
Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
You know, I was reading, you know, before I called you, I was reading the review that your colleague Jason Green wrote of the album, which is a beautiful review. I liked it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And he touched on what's become a common sort of narrative with this album, which is that it's a breakup record for Tom York. You know, Tom York, you know, he split up from his longtime partner last year. They weren't married, but they had two kids, I believe, together. And it's an interesting thing. I want to get your take on this. I mean, for me, I didn't necessarily read it as a breakup record. It reminded me of something Jeff Tweedy told me once. I interviewed him a couple years ago, and he said that like when people review Wilco records, they'll take the first song and they'll make the whole album about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like whatever that song sounds like, whatever it is lyrically, that becomes sort of what the album is. And I almost wonder if people have done that with the Radiohead record, but with the last song. Like, I wonder if True Love Waits, if that wasn't on this album, if people would still hear it as a breakup record. Because for me, in a way, it's more of a political record. Like, I see, like, a lot of apocalyptic imagery in the songs. And, you know, that's a common thing, obviously, in Radiohead songs. But, like, I feel like, you know, when it was OK Computer and Kid A and Hail to the Thief, that it was more speculative or looking ahead. Whereas this one, it seems like it's in the present tense, you know, and that, you know, there's allusions to, like, big mistakes that have been made that can't be corrected, you know. So it's almost like we're past the point of no return on this record, whereas maybe on OK Computer, it was more about the future. But yeah. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, do you feel like it's a breakup record, or have you read into it at all lyrically in that way?
You know, it's that funny dance that I think critics and fans have to do with, like, this idea of everything a narrator in a song says being the words of the person who wrote it, you know. And
right.
With Radiohead, it's just been, I mean, Thom Yorke is not, I wouldn't call him a lyricist who's written from, like, a bunch of, you know, ostensibly clear points of view that are outside his own. Like, that's not always clear, you know. It's not clear who he's speaking through all the time. Like, obviously, he's usually speaking in a very, like, big way. He's just speaking generally about, like, the state of things. And it's, I think when we hear him, in the rare times we hear him just be a lot more seemingly personal, it's like kind of in stark juxtaposition to these, like, monolithic themes he's usually talking about that
right.
People can't kind of help but, like, be like, okay, this is Tom opening up. And I get the argument that it's a breakup record, and I do see it. I do agree with you, like, that True Love Waits kind of puts, like, a more distinct point on that. But, you know, like, I look at a song like Identikit, which, you know, has been kicking around since 2012, just in live shows, and the fact that like Tom is on that song saying, like, broken hearts make it rain, and when I see you messing me around, I don't want to know, like, that feels very heartbreak. But
right.
I also, you know, there are a few songs that are, you know, still very political, as they usually are, from Burn the Witch to The Numbers, which is, I think, is just beautiful. But I get a little bit of it, but I'm not totally sold on it. Like, it just seems like slightly too easy of a narrative for a record that clearly has other songs that have nothing to do with heartbreak. You know, I would say that a lot of Radiohead records kind of do that, though. Like, people kind of look at it and say, like, oh, it's all about this one thing. I mean, that's a lot of records, like you were saying with Tweety, saying what people think Wilco records are about, you know what I mean? But
yeah,
I think people like to, and maybe this is a reaction to OK Computer, you know, like, people really looked at OK Computer and were like, you know, this is about consumerism and it's about this one thing, you know? And it's like, it's about a lot of different anxieties, you know? It's not just about this one thing. So I kind of just feel like we're sort of taking credit away from them, which sounds crazy because Radiohead are given absurd amounts of credit already.
Right.
So they can stand to have a little bit taken away. But I mean, I think about Hail the Thief. People were like, oh, it's the anti-Bush record. There's tons of songs on that album that are not, I mean, they're not overtly about that. You know, there's themes about that sort of carry through, obviously, but it seems kind of par for the course with what people tend to do with Radiohead records. I mean, don't
totally.
You think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you hit upon this. I think this is a great point. I mean, I think Radiohead songs, Radiohead records, I think where they get a lot of their power is the fact that they're lyrically opaque. And that they allow for people to project whatever meaning they want onto the records, and it makes them seem really relevant. And I think even musically, you know, if you compare where they're at now to maybe where they're at earlier in their career, I mean, you know, the first three records are much more sort of song-oriented, and there's even, like, real kind of guitar riffs on, like, songs from The Bends and OK Computer, and they've been moving more and more into sort of a more subliminal direction, like where songs maybe don't connect as they're coming out of the speakers, but as you become more familiar with it, there's enough space in the songs that you can kind of supply your own, you can fill in the missing spaces in the songs yourself, and it makes it feel kind of more powerful for that. In a way, I feel like that's what's kept Radiohead relevant, you know, because it's so easy to forget that This is a band. This is an aging white rock band.
Right.
And people talk about them like they would a Beyonce record or a Rihanna record, which is not true of any other band of their generation. I mean, Thom Yorke isn't that much younger than Bono is. But like, we don't think of him that way. And maybe it's because Bono is, you know, kind of hitting you over the head all the time with what U2 is doing, whereas Radiohead, you know, they kind of go into a shell which draws people in. I mean, does that make sense? I mean, do you feel that way or like at all with that?
No, I do, and I think going back to what we were talking about earlier about that period, right before this, not right before, but the gap between King of Limbs and even like the lead up to King of Limbs, like that sort of, I guess I would call it the this decade up into this point, up until last week, really. I think that there was sort of like maybe a little bit of this feeling about Thom Yorke becoming, I don't want, not a parody, but there was something where people could sort of, they wanted to roll their eyes more at him, seemingly, you know what I mean? And I think...
He grew the ponytail and he's hanging out with Flea. I mean, it just seemed like, all right, Thom Yorke, what happened?
Yeah, yeah, and some of it was charming. Like, I remember the, you know, the dance meme that came with King of Limbs, and there was some funny stuff where you feel like, okay, Thom Yorke is having a little bit of fun, but there was a little bit of it that just felt so, I think for me, the tipping point was like Tomorrow's Modern Boxes. I was like, I kind of can't get through this, and I respect that you want to release it in a weird way, but like, I just can't, like, this BitTorrent thing, like, I don't know that I can follow you, like, down this rabbit hole, because you just seem a little angry dude yelling at Cloud. Like,
right.
I mean, part of it was, like, the constant Spotify rants. And I completely respect, like, that he is not a fan of that service and their practices. And I, like, you know, it's a fine line between, like, you have a point and thank you for calling it out. And, like, okay, we don't need to belabor this point anymore. So I feel like we were getting to a slight point with Radiohead and Tom where... It kind of, maybe the respect level went down slightly, but this sort of, I think because this record is so good that people, that is completely gone. You know what I mean? That was like, oh, that was a thing that was happening, and now we're back to old Radiohead.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I mean, and I really think that they were really close to losing it. And it's amazing because we're not that far away from this album coming out, but it's already kind of hard to remember before this record came
yeah.
out. But I really do think that, and again, I'll just speak for myself, that I was really losing interest. I was not that excited even about this new Radiohead record, you know, in the build up to it. It wasn't really until I heard Burn the Witch and Daydreaming mm-hmm. where I got hooked back in. But, you know, that second Thom Yorke solo record, and can you tell me the name of that again? I seriously forget it every time you say it.
Tomorrow's Modern Boxes.
Tomorrow's Modern Boxes. I mean, can you even have a more drab album title for a drab album? I'm sorry.
If you
put the word boxes in your album title, it's not going to be a great record. I'm sorry. It's just not going to work. And I'd be honest, have you listened to that whole thing, that whole album?
Yeah, I can't tell you. I couldn't tell you one track off of it because it's been so long. Because I just had such a low interest in returning to it, honestly.
Yeah, I listened to it once, and I'm like, no, I don't think so. Because I think that came out after the Atoms for Peace record, which it just was so boring to me. I just could not get into it. It just seemed like Radiohead had reached the point that every band seems to reach where they're making records that, like, it's an artist that you've loved, so you don't really want to speak ill of it, but there's no excitement when you hear it at all. And it was just sort of odd for, you know, a Radiohead record to come out or a Thom Yorke record to come out and to not really feel anything for it. I mean, you know, even, like, The Eraser is a record that I like quite a bit. I think that's a really strong record, and Rainbows was really great. But, yeah, it just seemed like there was a lack of music coming out, and the music that was coming out was just not very exciting. I guess I like the Johnny Greenwood film scores, like for There Will Be Blood and The Master and Inherent Vice. That was good. But, you know, it's not really the same thing as like a record or something. You know, it wasn't I wasn't hearing those scores and thinking, oh, well, this means that Radiohead is still in a good place. Although it's interesting listening to Amun J. Poole, the influence of those film scores, I feel like. I feel like the strings on there reminds me of his work as a, you know, scoring films.
Yeah, I feel like that has really, it really informed this record in a beautiful way, and I really loved seeing him go in that direction. And obviously they've had, you know, they've done heavy strings at times in the past and had, like, beautiful arrangements by John Lubbock and some of the most amazing, you know, orchestras in the world. They've had work with them, but I think this record really kind of takes the cake in that way, and I don't know that it would have been. It seems like it would not have been so if Johnny had not spent, you know, the last, like, decade especially doing some really special film projects, you know, like, God, I will listen to There Will Be Blood score, like, every couple months, because it's terrifying, but it's, like, it's actually, you know, it's, like, very good and very affecting, you know, like.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, it's I love it, too. I mean, it's definitely better than Tomorrow's Boxes.
Modern Boxes.
Tomorrow's Modern Boxes.
Honestly, I'm never gonna remember that.
It's like the Men in Black thing. I swear, every time you say it, it's like you're flashing a light in my eyes, and it gets wiped. It's like my brain is just like, no, this isn't essential information. You can just get rid of this. I mean, is Radiohead essentially just Tom and Johnny at this point? I mean, like, you know, like, I don't know if I feel the influence of Ed O'Brien. I feel like Ed O'Brien just, like, disappeared after Hail to the Thief or something. Like, I just never feel like he was actually one of my favorite members of the band in the 90s, but it just seems like the records, it sounds like Tom and Johnny and maybe the other three guys are in the corner just going, like, you guys want some tea or anything? Like, can we help you out? Am I wrong? Or how do you feel?
I think it's hard for us to know. I mean, I think this felt much more like a band of people who were all contributing things at the beginning, and then as more time has gone on, it's emerged more that it's like it's Tom and Johnny who are taking the lead. But I will say, like, in defense particularly of Philip Selway, like, I think he is a fantastic drummer. I think he's one of the best drummers in rock music, though it's kind of weird to call it that because they have made so many electronic records too, you know.
Right.
I just think he's a fantastic drummer and very nuanced, and over time has gotten better and better and more interesting, you know. And it's interesting to hear what he does on the records where they have, you know, beats and more electronics, and I still always listen for him. I don't know, but I mean, yes, you have a point. Like, what do the other people do? I mean, I just think a lot of that we have no idea, you
yeah.
know, like, in the context of making the record, like, who knows? Like, maybe Ed O'Brien is, like, a genius in the studio and came up with, like, guitar lines that are just, like, playing on repeat in our heads, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
I hope there's,
but
like,
I hear you.
I feel bad for, you know, I feel like there's going to be, like, a biography that comes out in 20 years, and, you know, they'll talk about how Ed O'Brien has just been stoned for, like, the last 15 years, and, you know, maybe there's, like, a big, like, cache of, like, great guitar solos that he recorded for, like, King of Limbs that they just, like, erased, and he's just smoking weed to deal with the frustration of that. You know, that's my Ed O'Brien theory, by the way, that is based not at all in truth, but that's what I like. That's my, like, Radiohead fan fiction. But, yeah, I'm with you on Phil Selway. The thing with Phil Selway, too, is that he was quietly putting out the best Radiohead music or Radiohead-related music in the last couple years. I mean, I prefer his solo records to, like, what Tom York was doing, which was so weird. That's not what I would have expected, but he is sort of, like, the unsung MVP, in a way, of the band.
Yeah, I liked Weatherhouse, which is that record he put out a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Just, like, a quiet, you know, like, nothing that's going to, like, set the world on fire, but I appreciated it a lot, you know? Like, yeah, I do think he's kind of an undersung MVP of this band, you know?
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit, because, you know, we're talking about Radiohead here, and we're both fans, and we're, you know, it's clear that we treat their music with a lot of seriousness, and I'm sure there's people listening who are scratching their heads, wondering, like, why do people care about Radiohead so much?
Oh, totally.
You know, and I know, like, I know you're younger than I am. Like, how old are you?
I'm 27.
You're 27. So I'm 38. So I was like, I think 14 or 15 when Pablo Honey came out. So I've been listening to Radiohead from the beginning of their career. Like, what was the album for you that turned you on, or that came out like at the right age for you to get into them? Was it Hail to the Thief?
It was interesting. It was in that period between, it was around like 2002, so it was between Amnesiac and Hail to the Thief, and it was because I saw the Karma Police video on VH1, like in the middle of the night, like just when they actually used to play music videos instead of whatever they play now.
Right.
And I saw it, and I have to tell you, I mean, I'm from like a small town in Ohio, and nobody that I knew ever talked about Radiohead. I had never heard that of that band. I had never, you know, I was like 13 or 14, and I was, that was around the time I started subscribing to Rolling Stone, but I didn't know this band, and I saw that video, and there's like a few times in my life where I saw videos, and it was like I can remember watching them almost in slow motion because they had such an effect on me just instantly. Like, I saw that, and I was like, what is this? Like, I have never heard anything like this in my life.
I mean, was it the song or the imagery, or like, what was it about that video?
I think it was, the video scared the shit out of me because, you know, it's like he's like running on the road in the middle of the night in the headlights of the car, and it's terrifying, especially if you're a 14-year-old girl watching it in the middle of the night when you shouldn't be up, you know,
right,
in your house, like, and it's dark and, you know, but the song was like that, the piano line stuck with me that I was like, you know, this just feels different than something that I've ever heard. And obviously, yeah, the visuals terrified me. So for a minute, I was sort of like, what is this, like, what is this haunted thing? Like, what is this? And I just started, like, you know, looking into it. The internet was obviously around then. It was a bit different then than it was now. But
it's like tumbleweeds blowing through and all that.
Yeah, like nascent message board things, no Wikipedia, none of that. But, you know,
right,
obviously you can find information about OK Computer on the internet in 2002. So I just like asked for that album for Christmas, and my dad was like, my dad had never heard of it. My brother had never heard of it. And they like made fun of me terribly. They were like, Radiohead, OK Computer, what dumb names, like, what is this? Like, they just thought it was like so silly. Like, they were like, where did you find this? And it's just hilarious to me to think about now, because they were like a huge band. Like, they were so massive at this point. And my dad is like, what is this dumb indie band? And
right.
And I just, like, OK Computer just, like, kind of cracked my small, my, like, young mind. Just, like, I was like, what is this? And it was great. And I went from there. I mean, Kid A and Amnesiac, I both just got those, like, instantly. And then Hail to the Thief was the first record that came out that I was like, I'm going to Best Buy and buying this very first week. And, you know, a lot of the Bush stuff was, like, went over my head because I was very young, but and I didn't really like it. And I didn't really like Amnesiac or Kid A. Like, I was like, just kept going back to OK Computer. And it honestly took, and this is such a weird thing to remember, but it honestly took reading, I don't know if you remember this, Chuck Klosterman at some point wrote in, I think it was Spin, or maybe it was in Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. He wrote about how, Kid A, the 9/11
right,
connection to Kid A.
Right, right.
And, yeah, and I remember reading that, and it, again, my brain was sort of, like, completely blown, and I really, like, had a reevaluation of that entire era. And I was a little, you know, I was a couple years older, and I just got it a lot more. But it just kind of stemmed from there, and Rainbows was, like, easily the most important record of like my college experience, just hearing it like in real time and talking to people about it, like having like a listening party. And
it's like, were you a freshman in college or something when that came out about?
Sophomore in college. And we were just like in a dorm room, and I remember we didn't have any words. And then somebody finally spoke, and then of course there's one guy in the room who's like, okay, we're not talking, it's Radiohead. And it's like, okay, yeah, like people take this band really, really seriously.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about this, because in a way it's almost like you came to Radiohead when they were already maybe sort of a classic rock band. At least,
oh yeah,
they had
totally.
This established sort of persona, and you had a bunch of albums that you could go back and listen to. And yeah, for me it was a little bit different, because I remember seeing Creep on MTV, and that's how I was introduced to the band. And I was like, and I got Pablo Honey, and I loved Pablo Honey when it came out. It's funny, because Pablo Honey gets sort of shit on now. Like, people don't even, they don't even think of it as a Radiohead album. It's like, their history begins with the Bends, and that's it. I actually still think Pablo Honey is, like, really good. There's some really good, kind of fun, like, rock songs on there. It's obviously not as sophisticated as, like, their later work, but there's some really good songs, and they put out like some good B-sides at that time. And you know, I was just starting to get into like British music, so like they were actually a little bit before Oasis and bands like that. But I like Pablo Honey a lot. And then the Bends came out, and it's weird with the Bends because it seems so straightforward now, but when that record came out, it seemed like a lot weirder and different than Pablo Honey. And that was sort of like a difficult record when it came out. And again, that sounds weird, because it seems really, that's an album that people kind of hold up as, there's still people who are probably like, I wish they sounded like the Bends, because they did pretty much perfect that like guitar rock type sound on that record, I think. Maybe they realized that because they never made another record like that again, but like that's a perfect kind of like British rock, you know, just kind of straightforward type record. And then like what you were saying about In Rainbows, that was OK Computer for me. Like that was the album where if you were drunk at a party, like you would argue about like your favorite song in OK Computer, you know?
Oh yeah.
And like compare notes in that way. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting though, because we're both talking, you know, we came at them at different times, but we're both talking about albums of theirs marking points in our lives.
Yeah.
And do you have any thoughts on, like, why they're that kind of band? You know, why Radiohead and not, you know, some other kind of contemporary band that put out records at the same time but, like, don't seem to have that kind of significance?
You know, I think it's a real combination of things. Like, the point you were making earlier, which I kind of like to think of as, like, the Beach House effect. Like, having lyrics that are sort of, like, slightly vague, but have a lot of good imagery too, that people can project their own shit onto it. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
That's a lot of bands. That the band that does that the most to me is Beach House, but obviously that's a very different band than Radiohead. But for me, like, I do think there's a little bit of that with Radiohead. There's a little bit of them being smart, but not too smart. You know, like they're not. I don't think they're inaccessibly smart and high-minded. Like, they're arty and experimental, but to a certain extent, you know? Like, people still followed them down their rabbit holes for the most part because they could keep up. But they also were smart enough that they were sort of a signifier to people. Like, fandom for Radiohead, I think, is sort of one of those kinds of fandoms that people have that's just like, I love this band and this says something about who I am.
Right.
And well, that they're a band like that in a lot of ways, in my mind. I mean, I've met so many people who they're just so happy to like tell you that they're a Radiohead fan, or they have like the Radiohead bear tattoo, or they have the little kissing people from OK Computer, you know, the little, I almost got that tattoo. That I'm so glad I didn't. But no. And then the other thing is, I think because there was such a fandom around them on the internet in the nascent time of the internet with message boards, and I just think like the fandom became rabid because they were a community unto themselves, you know?
Right. You know, you just made a great point before where you said that they're smart, but they're not too smart.
Yeah.
And I think people who hate Radiohead always talk about how, well, if you like Radiohead, you're just trying to sound smart, or you're pretentious and all that.
Yeah.
And for me, what's always drawn me to that band is the emotionalism of their music. Like, when the Bends came out, that was my go-to wallowing record. Like, mm-hmm. when I was pining for girls who didn't like me back, I would listen to the Bends and, like, this High and Dry on there, and, like,
yeah.
Big Plastic Trees. And, like, it wasn't even about the lyrics. It was the sound of the music. There was an uplift to the music where it was very emotive. And even, like, an album like Kid A, you know, which seems very claustrophobic in a lot of ways, you know, there's an uplift to that music. There's a release to that music that, you know, for all of the sort of difficulty that exists on Radiohead records, in a way, maybe that's trying to obscure the emo quality at the core of it. Because, you know, the running themes in Radiohead's music, it's about, you know, disconnection. It's about, you know, feeling alienated from the rest of the world, you know, whether it's because of technology or the government or whatever. And, I mean, that to me seems like a very human emotion, but it's not a very cool emotion, you know? It's not something that is going to make you hip in any respect. And I really feel like maybe what I connected to when I heard A Moon-Shaped Pool was that they got back to that. You know, these songs are very emotional, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And the way that they're structured with you know, the prominence of the strings and the prominence of Thom Yorke's voice, and he's singing a lot in his higher register again, and there's like a lot of background vocals, like where it's these sort of high, he's doing the falsetto on a lot of the songs. It's sort of unabashedly emo, I feel like, ultimately, and that's, I think, what draws me in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, they are kind of, I mean, not to collapse it into this, but they're like, they're kind of whiny British rock. They still are. Like, they're smart, but they still fit into that, you know, like as much as high-minded as they get, you know, on their, you know, from Kid A to Hills of the Thief to Amnesiac, you know, like I would say those are the three most difficult records, if you want to call any of their records difficult, you know, but you still have like a good amount of what I would call maybe not whining, but definitely like very real anxiety that people can connect to, even though it is about these bigger topics. I mean, I think about like a song like How to Disappear Completely, and it's like it's that projection thing, that vagueness we were talking about of like, I'm not here, this isn't happening. Like, everybody has had that moment in their life and they can relate to that and use that. And there's tons of examples of that tucked in these like so-called difficult songs, you know, like there's emotion there. Even if Thom Yorke is not necessarily like always as emotive as he is on the new album.
Right. So you were talking about OK Computer being your gateway album. Would you say that's still your favorite Radiohead?
It's one of those albums, you know, like when you just listen to an album so many times in your life that you sort of run out of like your ability to even listen to it anymore. Like, it's a little bit of that. Like, I sort of like ran through all of my playbacks of that between the years of like 2002 and 2006, and I'm just like kind of like I have no spins left. But I love it, you know, like I do love it, and I would say all time, yeah, it's my favorite, but it's not the, I mean, I listen to In Rainbows, I think, the most.
Yeah, I was listening to In Rainbows a lot before this one came out.
Yeah.
That sort of, I was like pre-gaming for the new album, like I need to get psyched up for this, so I was listening to In Rainbows. That's actually a really good Phil Selway record, I think. I love his drumming.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, OK Computer, you know, I feel like I can still listen to it. I think that might be the best album of my lifetime. That would be an album that I'd be tempted to not, if I had to pick a best album of my lifetime, that would be a nominee anyway. That'd be like one of the five. I just think, you know, like when I was getting into music, I was into alt rock and I was into classic rock. And
yeah.
OK Computer to me felt like this is my Dark Side of the Moon or, you know, Led Zeppelin 4 or whatever. It seemed like it had that kind of heft, like, pretty early on. And it still has that for me. Like, it just seems like a record that you're going to – it's like its own continent, you know. And if you want to go to that continent, you know, you can explore it. And, you know, but maybe you've traveled to that continent a lot and you want to go to, you know, to Italy or something or Spain. So you don't want to go there anymore. But it's there for you to visit. And it's very vast, and there's a lot to explore there.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think about my own hearing you talk about how you came to it, and versus like my own experiences with it, and basically having this record that it was about isolation and the anxiety around it, and a lot of other things. But I think it all kind of circles around that feeling. And I listened to it completely isolated. I didn't speak to anybody about that record until I went to college. Some of the feeling around it, like the like bombast, you know, like I've had old bosses tell me about, like, I remember when OK Computer came out and getting mailed. Everyone talks about this. I feel like journalists love talking about when the advances for OK Computer came out, and they were such a big deal, and they didn't want them to be leaked, that they mailed them tape players that had the tapes glued in them. Like, they were glued shut, so they couldn't take them out and share them and pass them around. And it's just funny to me to hear stuff like that, because I had no sense of it. But it's kind of a testament to that record that somebody who spent, like, you know, 3 or 4 years with that record, basically speaking to no humans about it, the internet was a bit more nascent, you know, that I, like, had a sense of it being, like, its own world. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes people talk about records and they're like, it's its own thing, it's its own island, because, like, the cycle around it or the press around it or just the conversation around it has made it so. And OK Computer is one of those records that is just, the music makes it that way. It is not even the huge amounts of conversation that it generated. And I can like testify to that, you know, like, it's an incredibly powerful record. I don't know if it would be like top five Desert Island discs to steal a phrase for me, but it would be top 10.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, Jill, you know, it sounds like we're both going to endorse A Moonshaped Pool. It sounds like we're both enjoying it. I'm still listening to it a lot. Are you still?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I haven't gotten sick of it yet. And it's weird to say that you're already sick of an album 3 days after it came out, but that's like the world that we live in. It's like, oh no,
totally.
It's 3 days later and I'm still enjoying it. You know, what a miracle. But no, it's it's been great. And, you know, I'm so glad that you were able to talk with me today, Jill. It's been great talking Radiohead with you, and I hope we can have you back on here very soon.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I so loved it. And I'm still listening to it, too, but I hear you. Like, it's amazing. Sometimes we can just run. I think being critics or being fans, too, you can just run through shit so easily. You know, you just burn it out so quickly. But I'm definitely still bumping this new one.
Awesome. Well, Jill, thanks again.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. That was Jillian Mapes. That was a lot of fun talking with her about Radiohead and A Moonshaped Pool. Really interesting to get her perspective. She's like 11 years younger than me, so she came at them from a different perspective, but it's weird how, in a lot of ways, our experience with the band is very similar. I think it's probably true of every band that you love. They sort of mark time for you. So I want to thank you guys for joining us on this episode of Celebration Rock. And remember, if you like the podcast, it's always a huge help for us if you can help spread the word, whether that means talking to a friend about us or, you know, sending a tweet or a Facebook post about us or even leaving a rating and a review on iTunes. And otherwise, thank you to Mac Weldon for sponsoring this show. Thank you so much for listening, and we will be back next week with more Celebration Rock.